This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Since the pictures of abuse at Abu Ghraib prison became public, a great deal of information has come to light about the treatment and mistreatment of detainees in Iraq, Afghanistan, and at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. That includes a practice called extraordinary rendition. In brief, the CIA whisks terror suspects caught around the world back to their home countries for interrogation, countries that are often alleged to use torture. The policy requires a non-torture promise from the home country, but critics say that in practice, such promises are worthless. Extraordinary rendition dates back to the Clinton administration, but it's been used much more often since 9/11. The Bush administration and CIA Director Porter Goss defend the policy and insist that detainees who are transferred into foreign hands to countries like Egypt, Syria, Jordan, and Afghanistan are treated humanely. Several members of Congress, mostly Democrats, have a different view. They're calling for a ban on rendition, which they say violates international law and common decency. Later in the program, Justice in the Grass, a look at the war crimes trials and the search for justice after the genocide in Rwanda. But first, extraordinary rendition, the CIA and the war on terror. If you have questions about what extraordinary rendition is, how it's used, and how effective it is, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And we begin with Michael Hirsch, a senior editor at Newsweek magazine. He's been following the prisoner abuse story, and he's with us again here in Studio 3A in Washington. Nice to have you back on the program, Michael.
Happy to be here, Neil.
So when did information about rendition first come to light?
Well, in this latest context, it was obviously one of the outgrowths of the Abu Ghraib scandal, which, you know, really broke nearly a year ago, and really came up in the latter stages. As reporters began to learn more and more about not only the practices of Abu Ghraib and other Iraqi and Afghan prisons, as well as Guantanamo Bay, they began to get on the trail of what the CIA was doing. In particular, the CIA's role in the whole interrogations affair became especially prominent when we learned about the existence of various memos that the Department of Justice had written, the Office of Legal Counsel, in response to questions from the agency, from the CIA, about what kinds of interrogation methods could be used against particular suspects, mainly al-Qaeda. In particular, we reported this at Newsweek, that when Abu Zubaydah, who was a top al-Qaeda suspect detained early in the war on terror, began to be uncooperative, the question came to the Justice Department, you know, what do we do to make him more cooperative? And so there was a very, very now much commented upon memo, which was drafted by John Yoo, then with the OLC, and signed by Jay Bybee, the head of the Office of Legal Counsel, essentially justifying all sorts of aggressive interrogations and saying that the president had, you know, virtual carte blanche to do what he wanted in the war on terror, and that became enormously controversial. And so out of that grew more investigations, partly by the press, partly by Congress, of what the CIA itself was doing, and the so-called ghost detainee system whereby suspects were spirited away to foreign countries, sometimes to U.S. facilities. And, of course, many of these suspects we still know nothing about. So that's kind of where we are right now.
Well, with extraordinary rendition, what's the logic behind this?
Well, I think the logic behind it was that this was, you know, as the administration never tires of saying, a very new war that existed in some sort of penumbral state between actual war, outright war, where you take prisoners and you give them Geneva Convention protections, and a previous approach, which was mainly favored by the Clinton administration, of treating the terror attacks as a law enforcement problem, where you go and arrest guys and you put them on trial. There was a sense that this was, you know, we had to deal with it much more aggressively, there were no legal or indeed laws of war measures and provisions that accounted for what do you do when you capture, say, a Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who we now know is the mastermind in the 9/11 attack, and you believe he knows something about the al-Qaeda network and very possibly about future attacks. What methods are you justified in using to extract that information from him?
And again, put it in the context of the 9/11 Commission, for example. This has to do, again, with the whole focus away from criminal prosecutions toward intelligence gathering.
Right, right. And, you know, there has been an enormous debate ongoing in the intelligence community about the best kinds of best methods of interrogations. Do aggressive, even abusive interrogations actually work? Many intelligence many professionals who are involved in interrogation, both on the FBI and the CIA and the defense side, will say that, in fact, these kinds of interrogations often don't work because you get corrupted information from the individual in question. You get, you know, he'll say anything
to make the torture stop.
And a lot of it turns out to be just nonsense.
How widespread is this practice? Do we know how many people have been extraordinarily rendered?
No, we really don't. There was some testimony before Congress last year. General Paul Kern at one point told a congressional committee that he thought that it might be as many as 100. It has not, you know, come to light where they're held in most cases. Mm-hmm. There was one report in the Israeli paper Haaretz suggesting that a major detention facility was in Jordan. We in the media have focused on the one thing that we do know, which we did find out about, which is the sort of charter airline that the CIA has employed to spirit these guys from one place to another.
Others have called this the torture plane.
Some people have called it the torture plane, but what we've obtained from mainly European aviation sources some rather extensive itineraries of where these planes have gone, and the latest development in that a couple of cases involving detainee lawsuits against the U.S. government, the itinerary of the plane has conformed to their account of being seized, and so it's turned out to be important corroborating evidence in a couple of these cases for what they say happened to them.
Mm-hmm. And there are a couple of investigations underway where people were taken off the streets in Italy, or in the case of a German citizen down in the Balkans. People are looking into this as kidnapping cases.
They are looking into it. The German authorities have been investigating the case of Mr. Masri, who you were just referring to, we wrote about some months back, who was spirited, we believe, aboard a Boeing 737 that was used by a CIA front company. And in fact, the itinerary of that plane shows that it landed in Skopje, Macedonia, on the very date that he says he was taken away. That is being investigated. You also have the case of Mr. Arar, who is a Syrian-born but Canadian national who, while in transit in the United States, was taken aside, interrogated, and then ultimately sent to Syria, where he says he was tortured for many months, 9 months, I believe.
Now, as I understand it, a number, you know, the administration says, and President Bush said explicitly, this requires the home country to issue a promise not to torture this person.
Right. Well, this is the topic of an intense debate going on right now on Capitol Hill. There are a couple of bills, one particularly by Senator Pat Leahy of Vermont, who's the ranking member of the Judiciary Committee, which would attempt to take it beyond the level where it is now, where you receive secret assurances, essentially. Now, in the case of the Arar case, for example, we know that's what the U.S. government is saying, is that these assurances were made that he would be taken and not tortured, but there's nothing on paper about it.
I see.
The Leahy bill attempts to force the State Department to publish a list of countries that are known to torture, believed to torture, and to forbid the United States from sending detainees to those particular countries. But, you know, as of now, it's not clear how much support it has. I think even Republican critics of the administration's interrogation policies, like John McCain, for example, and Lindsey Graham, I think are a little bit reluctant to join and take part in and co-sponsor the bill.
Is there anything to back the suspicion that this is all done with a wink and a nod, and everybody knows that that person is going to be tortured?
Well, sources have told us, and I think other publications, that's pretty much, you know, what happens. When you send someone to Syria, or to Jordan or to Egypt, you're pretty well aware, you being the U.S. government, the kinds of interrogation practices that are used there, which are not in conformity with, certainly with U.S. law or with, you know, Geneva protections, which often involve physical abuse. And so the idea that, you know, a Syrian official is going to say to you, oh, don't worry, we'll treat him well, and then you're going to leave it at that, I think strikes critics of the administration's policies as very disingenuous.
We're talking about extraordinary rendition. Our guest is Michael Hirsch of Newsweek magazine. Our phone number, if you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. You can send us email, TOTN@NPR.org. Let's talk with Ray. Ray's calling from Reno, Nevada.
Hi, thanks for the show. Just wondering, wouldn't this type of action actually create more anti-American feelings, especially if the wrong people are picked up sometimes?
Well, I think there's no question that it has. You know, for Americans, the shame of the Abu Ghraib scandal and the photos that were published was that it did generate a lot of anti-Americanism and accusations of hypocrisy. You know, an administration that is supposedly trying to spread freedom and democracy and human rights, you know, appears, according to many of these accounts, to be, you know, to be able to deciding on its own when it can breach those very standards. And so I think there's no question that it did create that.
What happens if wrong people are picked up?
Well, that's exactly what some of these detainees allege, and in fact, there's a lot of corroboration. In the case of Arar, he claims that when he was picked up, he was in transit to the United States back to Canada, where he lives and where he's lived as a teenager, after being on vacation with his family in Tunisia. And in fact, after this long period of very rough, allegedly rough and abusive Syrian interrogation, he was released, and the Syrian authorities said they didn't think he had any connection to terror.
And the German man is said to be a case of mistaken identity,
right.
But three of these people have been released, is that correct, or at least as far as we know?
A number of them have been released. Some of them have been, you know, re-detained, but you also have some British detainees that have been, you know...
From Guantanamo.
Yeah.
Okay. Ray, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you very much.
We're going to take a short break. We're talking about the CIA's practice of extraordinary renditions. If you have questions about how it works and how effective it is, give us a phone call. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, our email address, TOTN@NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about the CIA policy of sending some detainees into the custody of foreign nations, many of which have been accused of torture. A practice is known as extraordinary rendition. You're invited to join the discussion if you have questions about what this practice is, how it's used, and the arguments for and against it. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, and the email address is TOTN@NPR.org. Our guest is Michael Hirsch, senior editor at Newsweek magazine. He's with us here in the studio. Also with us in Studio 3A is Mike Scheuer. He was the chief of the Bin Laden unit at the Central Intelligence Agency under President Clinton and the author of Imperial Hubris, Why the West is Losing the War on Terror. He joins us also here in Studio 3A, and it's good of you to be with us on the program.
Thank you very kindly, sir. It's a pleasure to be here.
You presided over this, the use of this practice during your time at the CIA. Is that right?
I did, sir.
And what sort of individuals qualified to be extraordinarily rendered?
First, let me say that there's two different programs we're talking about here. Mm-hmm. Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo have nothing to do with the CIA's program. And the second point I would make is that the program was assigned by President Clinton and Mr. Berger, Richard Clark, to the CIA in 1995. And at that point, we said, okay, we're a service organization. We'll take down the cells, we'll dismantle the cells, and we'll... help to have these people detained.
You're talking about Al-Qaeda.
And we said, where would you like them taken? And they said, sort of, over to you. And the response from the agency was, no, you don't get it. We don't have police authority. We don't have prisons. Where do you want them to go? And they said, over to you. So instead of working with the Congress or with the intelligence committees who were fully briefed on the program, to find a way to bring them to America, they left it up to us. And so we found we had to focus on those Al-Qaeda members who were, A, part of a legal process somewhere in the world,
mm-hmm.
B, in a country where we could persuade someone to arrest them, and C, have a country where we could take them to after they were arrested. Now, the agency's position would have always been more comfortable had we brought them to the United States. They couldn't do that for legal reasons. They weren't interested in trying to find a process that could be taken, so they went to third countries.
So if there was enough information to charge these people with criminal acts, you could have brought them to the United States, and that would have been fine.
No, that's really not the case, because very few intelligence services or police services overseas are going to let the FBI accompany them on an arrest. Therefore, there is going to be no U.S. officer who can swear in court that this person was never roughed up, mm-hmm. that the papers or the computers were never tampered with. So the basic
chain of evidence question.
Chain of evidence question, mm-hmm. sir. And really, I think in the on the long run, it's going to prove that we were too clever by half. The detainee program, the rendition program, has been the single most successful American counterterrorism program since 1995 till today. And we wouldn't be arguing about any part of it had Mr. Berger and Mr. Clinton and their successors now in the White House and the National Security Council worked with the Congress to find a way to bring these people to America. I might add one more thing. I think the media has covered this very widely, but they haven't covered it very thoughtfully. The goal of arresting these people was never to interrogate them. The goal was to identify people who were either going to participate in a terrorist attack on the United States or its allies, or someone who was involved in planning one. The first goal of the program was to incarcerate those people. The second goal was to get from them whatever paper documents they had and electronic documents, where they were writing things that they didn't expect the enemy to read. Interrogation was always the least important aspect of the program.
Mm-hmm. So that you would find stuff out from these documents, either electronic or paper.
The documents were always much more important than the interrogation, because they were information that the terrorists or the fighters had written without any expectation of it being read by a United States intelligence officer.
Then why take the additional step, if the interrogations weren't very productive, of sending them on to Egypt, Syria, wherever?
Well, sir, let me run down a quick list of the people who have been taken off the street. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the man who planned 9/11. His deputy, Tawfiq bin Attash, who helped plan 9/11 and who planned the attack on the coal in Yemen. Abu Zubaydah, who ran all of al-Qaeda's training camps in Afghanistan. Ramzi Ahmed Yusuf, the first World Trade Center bomber. Ramzi bin al-Shib, who was another sidekick of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and the al-Qaeda chief in the Far East, a man named Hambali. All of these people were targets and are now off the street. Now, if you don't want them taken to a third country, then you release them. And would you...
Well, all those people, are they held in another country's custody somewhere?
I don't know where they are at the moment, sir. I'm not part of the organization anymore. What I'm trying to say is that if someone has a gripe with where they are, then please go see Mr. Berger, Mr. Clinton, Mr. Clark, and the Congress and the intelligence committees, because only they had the power to arrange to have them brought to the United States.
I see. Okay. Let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. This is Ron, and Ron is calling from Fort Hood in Texas.
Hi, how's it going?
All right.
Yes, I just want to call. I just got back from Iraq within the last month. I was over there for about 14 months, and actually saw the detention process from the task force detention all the way up into the processing of prisoners into Abu Ghraib. And I just wanted to say that the prisoners actually at Abu Ghraib are the ones that have passed screening at the task force level, then up through the brigade level, and then the ones that really fit the bill for the terrorists we're looking for, and significant contributing factors to them being terrorists are the ones that are actually sent to Abu Ghraib.
Mm-hmm.
The ones that we actually have sent there had met all the requirements of guilt, as far as I can see, that they're suspicious enough where by going to Abu Ghraib, there was a high expectation that they were, their hands were dirty. However, and what I wanted to comment on was the extraordinary rendition process, and this is the first time I actually heard it called by that term, but I just wanted to say that I support it fully, from being on the ground and trying to ascertain information from personnel that have planted roadside bombs, or terrorist cells that are in action throughout Iraq, and them knowing that there's absolutely nothing we can do to them to get them to talk, because they know our policies, they know what our limitations are.
So you feel your hands are tied?
Our hands were tied, absolutely. And that would just put, it makes it much more difficult to defend a country when the people that are involved in attacking it know that there's nothing you can do to them if they just keep their mouth shut. Mm-hmm.
You say it's the first time you've heard it described as extraordinary rendition. What did you hear it described as?
I've never even heard it as a policy, as where we were transporting another country. That was something that my friends and I would talk about. Like, it would be great if we just turned them back over to their host countries and let them deal with the problem, because there's nothing we can do with them.
And Mike Shore, you said that's right.
Yeah, the lawyers call it rendition, but only the media that I know of have ever called it extraordinary rendition.
Okay.
No one, I'm not quite sure what the term means, but if it was good enough for the lawyers, it was good enough for us.
Okay.
If I might make a point here to follow up on that, I think the grandstanding that we're seeing by Senator Leahy and Congressman Markey, Senator McCain, Lindsey Graham, is really a dangerous grandstanding if they focus on simply the idea that these operations are undertaken to do interrogation. If they're unhappy with the destiny of these people, of where they're taken, then they ought to fix a way to bring them to the United States. But again, I just hope if they pass this ban in the Congress with a gasconade of misinformation, that they also put their names on the paper that says, yes, we prefer to have Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, Taufik bin Attash, and Abu Zubaydah on the street to protect their human rights rather than to take them to somewhere where they can be incarcerated.
Ron, thank you very much for the phone call. We appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
And Michael Hirsch, I did want to bring you back in on this. Is there a connection between this policy, which Mike Schreyer said is to be distinct from what happened at Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo?
Well, he's absolutely right. I mean, one of the tragedy of the Abu Ghraib scandal, as I've said before, I think on this show, is that what began as a arguably legitimate program of rounding up these known bad guys, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, bin Attash, and others, and getting them off the street by whatever means, began to migrate in terms of approach and thinking and interrogation techniques to apply to all sorts of Iraqi detainees. And I think one of the reasons that the recently returned soldier who was just on suggested, that he hadn't heard this term is because that was a separate, it was a separate policy there. You're talking about an insurgency war and rounding up and detaining those guys. And yet many of the same practices and indeed the legal justification that the CIA was looking for in detaining these guys migrated, in the words of the Schlesinger Commission report this past summer, to other theaters of combat involving an actual war like Iraq. And so you had a sort of conflation of the whole thing where probably innocent Iraqi detainees were rounded up. For example, many of the detainees that we know appeared in those photos at Abu Ghraib, we later learned, were just ordinary thieves. Some of them were innocent. Some of them were simply ordinary Iraqis who had nothing to do with the insurgency and the terror. And so what you had was this process, because of, I think, a lack of policy direction from the very top, you had a process by which the whole approach to interrogation began to expand to deal with thousands and thousands of people who had nothing to do with this original core response in the war on terror.
Mike Shore?
I would just make a quick point on what Mr. Hirsch said. It's indeed true that the agency asked for memorandums from the Department of Justice about what was permissible, but it wasn't done because we wanted to do it. It was done because we knew the politicians would abandon the agency, as for example, we've seen with Mr. Clark and Mr. Berger not coming forth to say that this was a presidentially authorized and sanctioned program. You always, as the intelligence service in the United States, want the politicians to sign up, because otherwise, if something goes south, they will be nowhere to be found until, they surface now with Mr. McCain and the rest of them beating their chests over this righteousness of theirs.
Mike Scheuer, thanks very much for being with us
today. My pleasure, Mr. Conan. Thank you.
Mike Scheuer, former chief of the Bin Laden Unit for the Central Intelligence Agency, author also of the book Imperial Hubris, Why the West is Losing the War on Terror, and he was kind enough to join us here in Washington in Studio 3A. We're talking about the policy of extraordinary rendition. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. As mentioned, this has become a measure that is being debated on Capitol Hill. Joining us now is Congressman Edward Markey, a Democrat from the state of Massachusetts. He's sponsor of a bill calling for a ban of this practice, and he's with us by phone from his office here in Washington, D.C. Very good of you to join us on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for having me on.
What would your bill ban exactly?
It would ban the practice of extraordinary rendition, ban the practice of outsourcing of torture, ban the practice of the United States of America sending prisoners, which we have captured, to countries that do not, in fact, abide by the Convention Against Torture, with the assurance from that country that they would not torture a person as the only guarantee that there would not be a violation of everything that America believes in terms of the treatment of prisoners.
I'm not sure you were here to hear on the phone when Mike Scheuer was talking, but he did ask those who were sponsoring such legislation to answer the question of if you've got a Al-Qaeda biggie, Ramzi bin al-Shib, what do you do with him?
He's saying the United States has captured the man?
Yeah.
And he's saying we've got him in our possession and we've got him behind bars? He wants to know what we do with him after we've got him behind bars? We do the same thing that we do with Saddam Hussein when we've got him behind bars. We keep him behind bars. We definitely do not send him to Syria, a country that we don't trust on many levels. In Lebanon, we don't trust them. But he, this gentleman you're talking to, he would say, well, you can send him back to Syria if you want to, with assurances, of course, that the person would not be tortured. But my feeling is, if we have captured him, if he's a threat to the United States, we have him behind bars, we have our own interrogators, we should keep him where he is and try to get information out of him.
If you don't have chain of custody, if you don't have a legal charge to bring against him, where do you do that?
Well, if we believe that we have evidence that someone is plotting against the United States and as a result we have arrested him, then we should present the evidence which we have against him.
In court?
In court.
And if the evidence is no good, you let him go?
If there is no evidence, that's what happened, as you probably know, with Maher Arar. That was somebody who was...
The Syrian-born Canadian citizen we talked about earlier. Yes, go ahead.
That's correct. And the United States kind of bundled him up, put him on a plane. He was a Canadian citizen, sent him to Syria. He was tortured in Syria. No information was forthcoming. And then the man was released. So I guess my answer would be, if you don't have any proof against somebody, you just can't be locking up hundreds of people because of their ethnic nationality, because you believe they may be suspects. You have to have some proof.
Let's get another listener involved in the conversation, and this is Leanne. Leanne's calling from Cleveland, Ohio.
Hi, Neil. Aren't there countries who use this provision of presumption of guilt as a way of actually capturing innocents and torturing them in other countries? And I would use the example of perhaps the KGB. And isn't it a slippery slope away from democracy and some of our core values?
Michael Hirsch, are you aware of any other countries that use a rendition?
A number of them certainly accept renditions. You mean the countries that would render to other countries?
Mm-hmm.
No, probably not, except by the request of the United States, but not in this kind of extra legal way. No.
Mm-hmm. What about Leanne's other point, Congressman Markey?
The other point was.
And the other point was, if this is illegal, why are we doing it? I think that adds up to that.
Well, again, we are signatories. That is, the United States is a signator to the Convention Against Torture. When we, with a blind eye, capture a prisoner and then send them to a country that we know engages in torture, we undermine our moral and legal authority in the world. When, if an American soldier is captured, we ask that that prisoner not be tortured because of the Convention Against Torture. So it just undermines our standing, and the caller is correct. For example, at the Nuremberg trials, the thing that made us the leader, the moral leader of the world, was that there were not charges that we had engaged in those kind of Nazi-like atrocities.
Leanne, thanks very much for the phone call. We appreciate it.
Thank you. And the other question that I'd have quickly is, don't we want to keep an eye on those that were behind bars, even if we don't have the evidence and they're wandering around somewhere? Wouldn't it be better if they're here and the CIA can keep an eye on them rather than in Syria?
Leanne, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Appreciate the phone call, though.
Thank you.
And Congressman Markey, thank you for your time today. Good luck.
Oh, thank you, sir.
Ed Markey is a Democrat from Massachusetts, member of the House Committee on Homeland Security. Joined us by phone from his office here in Washington, D.C. Michael Hirsch also with us here in Studio 3A. Thanks for your time, as always. Michael Hirsch is a senior editor at Newsweek magazine. When we come back from the break, another reference to the Nuremberg trials, this having to do with the first conviction of journalists for war crimes since Nuremberg. That's after the break. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.